go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! There in just a sec. All better now. You may be experiencing some buffering here for just a very brief period of time. And that happens a lot on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays because that's me uploading Dr. Bill's file to the Dropbox so that Ben can then grab it at his earliest leisure over at WhiteRoseSociety.org. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That is where you will find the link to the newly back up and fully running chat room with thanks going out to Duncan and to Lottie for making that work. Thanks, guys. And it's also where you'll find the listen live stream if you're on a PC. That's probably the easiest place to go just to get the live stream itself. If you like to listen on some other sort of platform, well, you can always always use an app like TuneIn Radio or Stitcher. The apps for both of those for your iDevice or your Android device are quite useful and quite handy. And it's also the home on HeadOnRadioNet.com is. It's also the PayPal button. That is how we keep all of the spinning on all the licks in all of the air. We try to raise $150 a night. Closed the week in a bit of a hole last week. I want to especially thank Horst and Waggy and Linda and Anthony and Dennis who got us out of that hole so that we're starting the week fresh and even today. This week's clean start brought to you by Horst and Waggy, and Anthony, and Linda, and Dennis. Thank you all very, very much. It is deeply appreciated. So all we got to do this evening is raise $150. 15 people at $10 apiece. 10 bucks at 15. 2 at 75. 3 at 50. 6 at 25. Am I okay? Yeah, I've almost got this stuff memorized. So that's where we stand. And of course, this is a special day. Ordinarily, we begin Moran Monday with, and oh God, yes, we have Morans. It's not like we're going to make Moran Monday stop being Moran Monday, but at the beginning of the program, a brief observation of what this day is and means, I think, is in order. You know, especially since the right wing's out there thinking that we on this side of the ideological divide, or as it in their case, the idiotological divide, being as how, you know, they're idiots. Think that we're some sort of unpatriotic trash. No, what we are is people who actually think about things. And we actually have a bigger and better and deeper understanding than just about any right-winger out there. You know, the love it or leave it types, or, you know, why don't you move to Iraq? You know, those people. And in my particular case, when November the 11th comes around, yes, that's exactly it, Waggy. The idiot illogical divide. IDIOT hyphen ILLOGICAL. Idiot illogical. They're idiotic and they're illogical. One flows from the other. But no, to me, and I think, okay, here's how it works out. And it's not because I'm special or anything. Hey, Ralphs! Ralphs in the chat room, Tim from L.A., Waggy, me. The rest of the crowd will be along shortly. We're not real authoritarian about it. You can wander in any time. If you've never been to the headonradionetwork.com chat room, this would be a great time to pop in. Now, it's the perspective of where I particularly land in all of this. I wasn't the early part of the baby boom. I was the very, very tail end of it. I guess demographers say that the baby boom ends in 1964. Well, I'm in 60. In 1963, when I was born, the Civil War was 100 years in the past. The Great War, the First World War, the war to end all wars, was less than 50 years in the past. The Second World War, of which my parents had been a part, was only 20 years in the past. And so for some, and because there were older generations of, I was just sitting here today thinking that, wow, I actually got to meet and talk with a World War I veteran. And it sticks with me to this day. He was an old, wiry fella. And it had been said inside the family that when he came back from over there, just wasn't quite right. And I guess I didn't understand what that meant, but the point, he'd never held down a job after he came back from Europe. He had quietly worked at farming. But I remember being little and him walking up to me and saying, "Sprechen Sie Deutsch?" He was an old fellow by that time. But he had learned that somewhere along the way in the course of his service in the First World War. He said things to me like, "Don't trust anyone too far, and don't trust anybody but yourself, and don't trust yourself too far." Don't know what that means. I have a suspicion, but I don't fully know. But the fact of the matter is, and somewhere there's a photograph, and I must find it. It would have been about 1932 or 1933 when a brother and a sister stood in a little schoolhouse window in rural West Virginia at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, and the little boy read "In Flanders Fields." And when he was done, the little girl from a different window read another poem called "America's Answer." The little boy was my uncle, who was recently laid to rest at the age of 92. And the little girl was my mother. And at the time that they read those two poems, the beginning of the Second World War was less than a decade away. I pondered that, and it absolutely stunned me. It's the things we don't know that wind up being the most shocking to us. They were in the midst of the Great Depression and wondering if they would ever get out of it. Although they did have a mold them in the not too distant that they had here was fear itself. It would only take another 70 years or so for a jug-eared, pin-headed, pig-eyed lout to occupy that same office and say, "All we got is fear, 9/11, or the terrorists win." So sometimes I feel the particular onus, I guess, of history. Not that it was any spectacular history. It's just the personal history of our family. But my God, if you could travel in time and say to that little boy and that little girl, and just tell them what was 6 or 7 or 8 years in their future, they'd run and hide. They wouldn't believe you. Or if they did, they'd be paralyzed by fear. And so it is that we go from day to day in what Robert Penn Warren referred to as the awful responsibility of time. But it is November the 11th, it's 2013. And for me, because I was taught this way, and because that was the way they experienced it, on that day in the early 1930s, it was Armistice Day. There was no such thing as Veterans Day. It would take the 1950s and the Communist Red Scare to turn the commemoration of the end of humanity, of what up until that time had been humanity's most brutal, most unenlightened act of self-immolation, into a national holiday for honoring everyone who had ever served in the military. But I was raised to remember that it is Armistice Day. There was a day once upon a time when the conflagration ended and people thought, well, we're not going to do this again. But people like Georges Clemenceau and David Lloyd George were damned well determined to make sure it happened again, and consequently you get the Treaty of Versailles. Because they were more interested in vengeance than they were in peace. And so you can make an argument that, in fact, Georges Clemenceau and David Lloyd George are the midwives of the birth of the Third Reich. So I've been thinking a lot about the First World War today. And because, you see, come next August, less than a year away, we will mark the 100th anniversary of the beginning of that long human nightmare. And I'm not seeing just a hell of a lot of anybody noting that. I think we paid more attention to the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic than we've paid thus far to the beginnings. Because, you see, by now, November 11th, 1913, 100 years ago, the seeds had already been sown that would result in the flaring up of flame that was the First World War. And granted, I don't get up and read the whole internet every day just like News Ninja Gene does, but I'm not seeing a lot of reference to it. And then this. We have a note from Dr. John, who is always wise with perspective. He says, not sure if I'll be clear what I mean here, but I think it will be. I hope we can clearly separate what it is that we're remembering today. Recall that November 11th was first recognized as Armistice Day. The goal was to remember the dead of World War I, and by extension to remind ourselves that very little is really worth the deaths of millions of people. All notions of honor and chivalry aside, modern war is wholesale, mechanized slaughter. Later, in the bloody 20th century, we shifted to honoring all veterans on this day. Well and good, Dr. John says, but there's a major difference between, in the first case, honoring the dead and marking the horror of gas and the trenches, and in the second, honoring all who served in uniform. I suggest that the concept of Armistice Day is slightly more worthy of remembering in the scale of human events, and that Veterans Day, in a way, works to minimize the former. My point is that the meaning of today has undergone a subtle shift, and that shift is sometimes even more pronounced. Take the concept of thanking veterans for our freedom. It's everywhere, if you look for it. I caught several versions of it watching the NFL games on Sunday. I'm sorry if this upsets some people, but the idea that we owe our freedoms to the military is utterly 100% false. Saying that betrays an ignorance of our founding documents and the intellectual legacy of the Enlightenment, and defines freedom in a way that I do not recognize. Take freedom. We're all free to do what? To sell our finite lives piecemeal to a boss so he'll get richer? Some freedom. Free to buy cheap goods whose entire chain of production is dripping with exploitation? Some freedom. Scratch deeply enough into any modern war, and you find a defense of capitalism. If we owe our freedoms to defenders of capitalism, and the freedom we win is the freedom to be exploited, I'll pass, thanks. But that's not really what people mean by that phrase. They mean we owe a much more nebulous sort of freedom to the military. The sort of freedoms the founders talked about, and that we recognize today as human rights, life, liberty, self-determination, etc. We absolutely do not owe those freedoms to the military. Read the Constitution, and Locke, and Madison, and on and on and on. Those are innate rights. The word inalienable means something, damn it. It means a thing that cannot be separated from its holder. We have those freedoms because we're sentient, self-determining, rational humans. No Enlightenment thinker or founding document predicates those qualities on a military. Moreover, if the military gives us life, liberty, etc., then the military has the right to take them away. Again, no thank you. That's not a vision of a society that I want to be a part of. In sum, let me be clear that I have no disrespect for anyone who has served. I have the normal amount of respect. Using veterans as a prop to justify capitalism is the height of disrespect. And to that I say amen. There's a line, and it is put in the mouth of a fictitious character who was a composite, but you've heard me mention the John Sayles film Mate One. It has to do with the opening of the coalfield wars in southern West Virginia just shortly after the First World War, when a bunch of men came home after making the world safe for democracy, as they'd been told, and found out that democracy, the world they had made safe for democracy, was some other world besides the one they lived in, because they were immediately re-enslaved and put back into disastrous coal holes where life was cheaper than the cost of a bank mule. It led to some ill feelings. But that fictional character, labor organizer Joe Kinahan, says something to the effect of, he's talking about having been locked up at Fort Leavenworth during the First World War. He said, "All I saw was workers killing workers." Because, of course, while a killing was being made in the trenches of France and in the mountain passes of the Alps in Italy and Austria, and on the blood-soaked shores of the Gallipoli Peninsula and elsewhere, a killing was also being made on Wall Street. Make no mistake about it, America's capital class got filthy rich off of the First World War. And they were the ones, in fact, who beat the drums for the war, for the U.S. to enter the war. Now, Europe started the war all by its own stupid self, based on interlocking and interopposing treaties that they, in their cleverness, agreed to and then found themselves having to live with. But the U.S. entry into the First World War was, as Calvin Coolidge would say, as President of the United States only a few short years later, a matter of business. The business of America is business. And of course, it's worth remembering that had they not, had members of the family not enriched themselves on, among other things, the American War Materiels Board, well, George W. Bush may have just been some little half-drunk little league coach in Texas or Connecticut instead of the man who is whose name is literally a curse to more than a million people in the Middle East whose deaths he callously ordered. This note came in from our buddy Rob. He said, "Hey, Bob, in 1969, I found myself in Pleiku, Vietnam, serving my country in a totally unnecessary war based on lies. Sound familiar? Personally, I can do without the gratuitous thank you for your service bullshit. I realize people are just trying to be kind, but the thank you that matters most is a robust VA system with decent health care and other benefits. P.S. I've been enrolled in the VA health care system for many years. It has improved a great deal over the past 20 years, at least it has in the Minneapolis VA Medical Center, and I like that a lot." Rob closes, noting, "Wolverines!" Thank you, Rob. Thank you very much. And then, over on my Facebook page, I was musing on the meaning of Armistice Day, the forgotten meaning of Armistice Day. And, in the course of that conversation, our friend For the Earthy sent a poem along. She says that it came from a friend of hers. She says, "My husband, a World War II vet who never participates in vet activities, said of the poem, 'Right on.'" The title of the poem is "Save It." Save your forced tears, your knee-jerk thanks for service, your ringing allusions to freedom's price, your raucous parades marching to off-key brass, your trembling, fat-gutted salutes, your cheap nationalist pride. You want to thank a veteran for real? Quit making so goddamn many of them. Texas Betsy notes, "My best friend is a vet. Her husband is active duty, and he still finds it very awkward when he's running errands or picking up the kids and in uniform, and people thank him for his service. I had one fellow tell me a few years back, he said, I can't stand that thank you for your service stuff. He said, 'You want to thank me for my service? Just say, welcome home.'" Welcome home. And Mark writes in regard to Dr. John's remarks, he says, "11-year veteran and volunteer, I agree with John's statement and interpretation of truth. War is a racket. Semper Fidelis." John, with regard to "All I Saw Was Workers Killing Workers," John says, "Didn't Muhammad Ali say something similar about Vietnam except filtered through the lens of race? And he got a reward for it, didn't he?" Yes, he did. He went to jail. "I ain't got nothing against no Viet Cong. Ain't no Viet Cong ever called me the N-word." Oh, by the way, in regard to her friends, Texas Betsy says, "My friend and her husband haven't been able to get a VA housing loan because of the sequester. Thank you, Ripig Lickens." Thanks indeed. What did I see today? Either something like, oh, there it is. Yeah. The GOP's food stamp cuts would knock 170,000 veterans out of the food stamp program. So the next time some Republican says they support the troops, you have my complete approval to tell them to stick it where the sun doesn't shine, that you don't support the troops by making sure that they damned well starve when they get home, or by trying to privatize their perfectly good universal single-payer health care. $170,000 veterans would be thrown off the food stamp program if the GOP gets its way. Worth noting. Shorty in L.A. said, with a note, Armistice Day and my dad. You know, finally, after all the other memorials were built, they built the World War II memorial. My father and I were supposed to go to D.C. to see it today. Well, last month he decided he was not up to it, so I sent him the money I would have spent on me from me in L.A. and from where he is in my hometown of Chicago. See, when he came home from fighting in what he called Patton's Army, he had a long train ride from New York to Chicago. He said he was proud that he served and got medals. He said the only bad experience he had was coming back home on the train. After all that fighting, he would reduce back to being a colored man and had to ride in the colored section of the train. After all that fighting, he was reduced back to being a colored man, riding the colored section of the train. He said that really upset him. Me too, says Shorty. Me too. And of course, you can make the argument that it is out of the ashes of the Second World War that arise things like the civil rights struggle. It was 1948 when Harry Truman ordered the integration of the military. That came before any sort of public integration. Things are learned. The question is whether or not we can continue to know what we have learned, or to remember what we have learned. Tim from L.A. says, today's Veterans Day, to many a time of reflection and remembering sons, daughters, friends, mothers, fathers, uncles, aunts, and grandparents who fought valiantly against the enemy of the United States, or at least their interests, and the sacrifices made. Today's war, like many, are fought for corporations or natural resources, and the above-mentioned vets above come home shell-shocked or today with PTSD. Many of us don't even care about war, and we want our soldiers to come home, get treated, and for the U.S. to end the illegal occupation of some poor third-world country. Yet at school there was a Thank You Veteran memorial today. I went downstairs to take a look while Tora Tora Tora, which I had an uncle who was the art director named Yoshiro Muraki, was playing on the big screen on AMC. I looked at the collage and saw something was missing. My uncles. My people. The 442nd Regimental Combat, 100th Battalion, 522nd Field Artillery Battalion, 1399th Engineering Construction Battalion, and Military Intelligence Services. Three of my uncles fought in the 442nd, and one in Japan deciphering the intelligence. My two uncles and my dad's cousin fought in Europe in the most deadly campaigns because they were Japs. They were expendable, yet fought tooth and nail. My father's cousin died serving the 442nd. This lack of history at school really upset me. The emotions I felt this afternoon were like, well, we were attacked and killed, U.S. soldiers in Pearl in Hawaii, but there was nothing about the segregated Japanese-American soldiers who fought not only for freedom, but to prove we were loyal U.S. citizens. Two of the three of my uncles are dead today. The Nikkei soldiers are fading away, and there's a little trivia. Did you know that the 522nd Field Artillery Battalion helped liberate a Dachau sub-camp? I learned about this some 40 years later when the top-secret classification was over, which was placed on the Americans because we were in concentration camps, too, the Japanese were, in the United States. Though many of us, including me, feel that all wars are a racket for the corporatists, there were heroes who fought not only for their country, but for our place in the U.S. to prove that we are Americans, even though the Democratic Party during World War II thought differently. I'm proud of my relatives, but one relative had to die to prove that they were loyal U.S. citizens. Like Major General Smedley Butler said, war is a racket, and the 18,000-plus medals proved it to the last soldiers. And, of course, that's another part of my thinking. Once I get past the First World War, I think of at least two men who are in the dirt that I never got to meet, and instead whom I was told about. One dead in the Battle of the Bulge, and one dead in what can only be described as one of Churchill's cockamamie schemes. He had Churchill had 1,000 ideas a day, and 999 of them were utterly insane, and one of them was pure genius. The trick lay in figuring out which one was the pure genius, and sometimes they picked the wrong one, and among many others, my uncle paid the price for that poor choice. So, yeah, Armistice Day, Veterans Day. We'll take a little break, and then, because I think we've got to have some sort of, I don't know, spiritual or whatever break to away from this portion before we can go into the business of morans. This is the horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Yeah.
What is it good for?
Absolutely
nothing. Take it away. Oh, whoa. Good God, y'all. What is
You know what? That song was released in 1967, and it has not lost a dime's worth of relevance from then to now. Forty-6 years. Edwin Starr. The song was originally recorded, by the way, by the Temptations, but Motown decided not to release it as a single by the Temptations because they were afraid of alienating the Temptations' more conservative fans. Or so saith the Wikipedia. By the way, Ron and Raleigh, who sent that along, noting, P.S., the Wakefield High School Wolverines took the Cap 8 football championship Friday. Can't keep them Wolverines down. Jeremy saying, perfect bumper as always, Bob. You can thank Ron and Raleigh for that one, Jeremy. And Mark noting, the 442nd, U.S. Senator Daniel Inouye, member of the 442nd Medal of Honor recipient. Shakabra. Mark. Randy with a reminder. By the way, Bob, careful. Currently, some of the heroes are spying on you. Shout out to Agent Fred. Agent Fred, you patriot, you. And one thing, before leaving the topic. I submit to you that there are three names that will not be celebrated on this day hardly anywhere. The three are Messrs. Schenck, Frowork, and Debs. Of the three, you probably recognize the name of Eugene V. Debs. 5-time socialist candidate for president. Largest vote garnerer of any socialist or of any third-party candidate for president in the history of this country. In the determined frenzy to go to war in 1917, the Congress got busy and passed something called the Espionage Act, which, interestingly, is still on the books. The Espionage Act of 1917, and when people began, and we must understand that opposition to warfare is nothing new in this country. The draft riots of 1864 in New York City come to mind. We don't really know what kind of hellish conscription the thugs of the Confederacy engaged in. Well, we probably got an inkling. But Woodrow Wilson campaigned for president in 1916 on the promise he'll keep us out of the war, because by then, by November of 1916, the war in Europe was 2 years old. And it was already clear that it was a vicious bloodbath, including massacre and slaughter on a scale that even the Civil War veterans couldn't conceive. And those were folks who had lived through places like Shiloh, where more people were killed or wounded in one day than were lost in all of America's previous wars combined, or God knows Antietam, or the slaughter pens of Devil's Den. Or the peach orchard at Gettysburg. And so Woodrow Wilson campaigns for the presidency on the promise that he will keep us out of war. But you know what? In a country whose operating philosophy is not freedom, or the Constitution, or liberty, but is instead business. Well, Woodrow Wilson could only hold back the capitalists for so long, because they was going to have them some war. Because it was mighty good for the bottom line. Hell, they knew that war could never touch American shores. They could go ahead. They could gin up war materials and get rich. So to go along with our entry into the war comes the Espionage Act of 1917, which was a total clampdown on all forms of dissent. And in the Schenck case, a man was prosecuted for criticizing the war. In the Froework case, a man was prosecuted for criticizing the war. And along comes Eugene V. Debs. Who was a proud and patriotic American who happened to be a socialist. Who said some things that are still mighty relevant today. It was June the 16th, 1918, when he gave an anti-war speech in Canton, Ohio. Because this country was deeply divided over America's entry into the war. Especially because there were a lot of Germans and a lot of Italians in this country who were disinclined to think it was in America's best interest to go to war in support. Because remember, the First World War was started by one family. They were all related. Whether it was the ruling house in England or the ruling house in Germany or the ruling house in Austria or the ruling house in Russia, it was a family squabble that cost the lives of millions of people. And probably the best argument to this day for getting rid of monarchy altogether. But speaking for those who opposed the war, Eugene V. Debs very, very carefully, having read the Espionage Act, spoke against it. Nonetheless, he was found to have violated the Espionage Act because it was understood that people listening to his speech might decide that that joining the army and going and killing in the name of capitalism was not in their best interests. He was his conviction under the Espionage Act of 1917 was upheld, and he was sent to prison for 10 years and stripped of his citizenship. A couple of years later, his sentence would be commuted. Ron and Raleigh noting, the Espionage Act of 1917. Hey, Bob, guess which president chose to dust off this hoary piece of crap? You're right, sir. Whistleblower? I say spy. Yeah, that would be President Not Sure. Robert with a reminder from up over. In Australia, we call it Remembrance Day. It's marked by 1 minute of silence at 11 a.m. Many stores and businesses would make an announcement over their public address system, and everyone would stop for that 1 minute. Sadly, this doesn't happen as much these days. Remembrance Day in the U.K., too. I think y'all probably deal with it better than we do. Because, remember, America tends to think that it was the only nation involved in either World War I or II. Russians? What Russians? Remember, the Americans arrived in Europe in 1917 as the American Expeditionary Force under General Blackjack Pershing, whose previous claim to fame had been failing to hunt down Pancho Villa. Yeah, he had to have another gig in a big way. So, the American Expeditionary Force arrived in Europe and ingratiated themselves to their hosts by explaining that no, AEF did not stand for American Expeditionary Force. It stood for After England Failed. that, you know, the Tommies just weren't up to it. That it would take American grit and gristle and know-how to win that there war. When in fact, well, yeah. Texas Betsy noting, I was in an in-service today where they asked the vets to stand and get applause, but nothing at 11:11 local time. My grandmother, she says, got her brothers out of Russia to keep them out of the Russian army in 1916. It's worth remembering that a lot of Russian soldiers went to the front with not even so much as a gun. They had to wait for somebody to drop dead, be shot, so that they could have their rifle. Danny, with an email, says, "Great conversation, Bob. This quasi-soldier worship we're being sold has always made my stomach turn. In fact, if one uses the words liberty, freedom, constitution, and patriot, I run the other way. The profits made off of killing people who don't know why we're killing them and their loved ones is just making us more enemies with each bomb. This day holds special value to me, too, as I don't believe World War I has ended, and it can't end until the last theater of that war is resolved, as other parts of the globe were. And that part is the Middle East. True, it did end many monarchies, change state borders and boundaries, etc., but as we all know, it was resumed very shortly thereafter in 1939 Poland, then the Cold War, and so forth. The larger, sadder still truth is that World War I will not and cannot end until we let the countries of the Middle East settle their own issues, including state boundaries and creations of new states. Hell, we had a civil war. I don't mean to sound flippant about civil war, but it's not up to us about how the artificial countries of that region resolve issues in ways we want or in ways we think we can control. We can't. Only they can. Look how well all those states have turned out from our meddling and creating artificial states. I don't want war, or for them to all descend into civil war, but it simply is not in our control, and the sooner we realize that, the better. It's kind of hard to do when we're selling weapons by the hundreds of billions of dollars to friend and even foe. Hell, we even have a client state, Israel, that can do no harm in many Americans' eyes. Then add petrodollars, and it's just a clusterfuck of unimaginable proportions. May the gods forgive us for all the madness in our meddling. Thanks, Danny." And that's true. The Middle East is the last tottering remnant of the nightmare that was the First World War. And all those artificial boundaries. Oh, we're going to call this one Iraq. We'll call you Jordan. Hey, we'll call you Syria. And you, we'll call Lebanon. And the only point of reference they had were previous colonial boundaries. You know, going all the way back to ancient Rome. Syria, Palestina? Hello? Dr. John, noting, the Espionage Act was part of a war tradition. We have a tradition of going absolutely ape in times of war. Witness the Alien and Sedition Act, backed by John Adams. From the Library of Congress, these acts increased the residency requirement for American citizenship from 5 to 14 years, authorized the president to imprison or deport aliens considered dangerous to the peace and safety of the United States, and restricted speech critical of the government. Take that, Bill of Rights! And that's the problem. That was under Adams' presidency. And, oddly enough, he seemed a fairly rational human being until he became the president. Same can be said for Jefferson. Oh, look, he was for small, limited government until he became the president, and, hey, I think I'll buy some real estate. What do you mean there are people that already live on it? Tell them their great white father loves them very much and sends whiskey. I probably need to explain that a little more often. Linda with a question. How do I add you to my Skype contacts? Well, Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn. Look it up, add me, and as quick as I see it happen on my screen, we'll be buddies. So, great. All right, let's go to the lines and just see what y'all's input is. 304-658-3333 is the number on Skype. Yeah, Bob Kincaid Horn. BobKincaidHorn. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hey, Jim.
How are you today?
Pretty good, I think.
Well, I'm not going to get into any thank you type thing because I do that every day of the year. But the only thing I can say is I'm very grateful to these people who did what they did and who gave so much for so many. And it's just one particular story that I would like to share with you, if I may. It won't take very long.
Go right ahead.
When I was a boy, I was a very sickly child, and I had this type of bronchial thing in which I would go to bed at night and wake up in the middle of the night. I wasn't able to breathe. It was like, if you said about your father, drowning on dry land. And our family doctor was Dr. Andrew B. Whitaker. Now, Dr. Whitaker was quite a gentleman. He really was. He was a physician. Also, he was in the Navy as a lieutenant commander. And when he came back after the war as a veteran, he reopened his practice. And in front of his office, there was a metal sign, and it's on its gravestone today, of the country doctor who would come with a horse and buggy. And I can remember not being able to get my breath. Dr. Whitaker, by my bedside, in his pajamas, saving my life. And here was one veteran who, if it had not been for him, I wouldn't be here today. And after the war, he came back and, as I said, opened his practice. And he and my father were good friends. And my father had a lot of problems. And it was PTSD. They didn't know it at the time. And he gave my dad some advice. He said, Jimmy, he said, what you need to do when these things come upon you is to do something that is physical and sort of mindless in a way. And so after that, of course, he knew my dad was interested in archaeology and stuff like that. He prescribed as his therapy, not shock therapy, not medication, things of that nature, because tranquilizers and stuff, well, who knows back then. But that was just going through fields and hunting Indian arrowheads. And I used to follow my dad when I do this. And we,
especially after the soil would be turned in the spring, right?
Exactly. But that man was, Bob, I'm going to tell you something. I remember going to his office as a small boy, and there was an oil picture of him. And he was in his naval officer's uniform, sitting in a chair, you know, posed, I guess, or whoever did the picture, or certainly knew how to do it. And there he was with a cigarette in one hand, and he was in that white naval officer's uniform, and my God, he looked just like Clark Gable. He certainly did. And as a matter of fact, he would tell my dad, he said, you know, I can't keep the women out of here. And there was a friend down the street who was on ship with Dr. Whitaker. And he said, well, whenever we went port, Dr. Whitaker was a ladies' man, and after the ladies he went, the God knows the ladies sure came after him. And they certainly came after him when he got to the point that he had to have a door cut into so that he wouldn't be in there with any woman alone. But this man was a family friend, and I can remember he got very sick, and he had what was called histoplasmosis. And the last I saw of him is when he came to see me when I was a freshman at the Citadel during that hell week and got me out of that and took me out to dinner in Charleston's Finest Restaurant. And I remember him, he was a mere shadow of his former self because he had to have his blood changed. It was called a thickening of the blood. But, you know, every time I think of him and the service, not only did he give to his country, but also the service he rendered to me and to my father and so many other people, because he was certainly far ahead of his time. He's a one veteran whom I want to remember for saving my life and probably saving my father's life too.
And given the nature of little small town country doctors, God knows how many lives he brought into the world and how many he saved once they were here.
He certainly did, and he was so far ahead of his time. And this is a different slant to saying thank you, but I'm just grateful to this man and so many others. And doctors don't come to your house anymore, but he, because of, well, he knew my dad very well. And like I say, I remember you talked about your father when he was having problems breathing. I had the same thing. And he was able to, because of experience that he had had in the Pacific, and also he was, like I say, very much ahead of his time. He was able to, almost in the 50s, bring about miracles. And I have a picture. I'm waiting for it to come in from Quaker Cemetery. And on his tombstone, there is that sign that used to hang in front of his office. And he's the one I remember today, as well as members of my own family, which would really be redundant in certain ways. But redundant, but not certainly without enormous amounts of gratitude.
Hear, hear, Jim. Hear, hear.
Andrew B. Whitaker, M.D., Lieutenant Commander, United States Navy.
Was he a doctor in the Navy, too?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And he had a lot of experience then in dealing with people, men within his, not command, but in his practice on the ship of dealing with PTSD and things of that nature. He knew exactly what would the gunfire, the shells bursting on ships. And, you know, when you're on a ship, when it gets hit by a large shell, I mean, you know, you're going to see your best friend, who was once your best friend, standing beside you, not even there, or pieces of him there, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I mean...
It's horrible.
I have those stories from my father, and I can't begin to imagine what it was like to be, you know, 20 years old and living through that.
Exactly, because at that age, you know, you think you're invincible, and, you know, it's a great, you know, type of thing that you're going, an adventure, that type of thing. That's the way you are at 1920 and stuff like that.
Well, if you look, and you can probably find it pretty easily online, if you look up USS Essex, ESSEX, kamikaze attack, 1944, it's a very, very well-known photograph. And my father had just gotten a break from being down in the bowels of the ship and had gone topside for a smoke with a buddy of his. And he looked at his buddy and said, "Well, time's almost up. I'm going to hit the head before I go back down," and left. A couple of minutes later, his buddy was, you know, reduced to the a million constituent pieces as the TNT-laden kamikaze aircraft exploded on the deck of the Essex in the very spot where they'd been sitting.
Oh, yeah. There are a lot of stories like that of people who, for some reason, just left in the nick of time and were spared losing their lives. But nonetheless, that's just one story I wanted to share with you. And like I say, when I was a kid, I had a lot of problems. And we had a next-door neighbor named Joseph Woods Brunson, who was also an MD. And I can remember when Dr. Brunson, when I was ill, would hop the fence and be over there in his pajamas and stay all night.
It's an odd coincidence, this story, because the doctor who took care of me when I was a little boy was a Navy veteran, and handsome as hell, and tall. Oh, my God, he was just crazy tall. And he, his nickname, and I never knew quite why, was Tut. Tut, T-U-T. And he, by the time my father passed away in 2007, he had retired from his practice. But early on, we'd been visiting down there, and he was still practicing. And early on, I even took my baby daughter to see him because she got sick while we were visiting my parents down there. And I always thought the world of me and I of him. And lo and behold, when the newspaper published the obituary that I wrote of my father, he showed up. He was somewhat stooped. He was an octogenarian by then. And he came and he said, I wanted to come. And he had that. An Alabama Southern accent is different from a South Carolina Southern accent, of course. But he said, as soon as I read that obituary, I knew that I had to come here to not only pay my respects to your father, for he was a fine man, but he said, I just wanted to see how you turned out, because the minute I read that, I knew you had written it. And we stood there and we talked and he reminisced. And, yeah, he got, because I too, Jim, was sickly as a kid. And if you could get it, I got it. I mean, I'll never forget the day that he looked at me and he said, by Jove, I don't think I've ever seen a boy get the mumps on both sides twice. You, sir, are a medical miracle of sorts. Because I had. Got chicken pox, and a week after getting over chicken pox, got the measles. You never cease to amaze me, he would say. But, yeah, we've got those people in our lives, Jim. And whatever time we have to be cognizant and remembering of them, well, you know, we have our differences about things like this, Jim, but I believe that immortality lies in memory.
It definitely lies in memory. It definitely lies, you know, elsewhere with me. But I just wanted to share that. And also, by the way, Dr. Brunson was a graduate of my alma mater. He even sent my recommendation for me to be enrolled there. And there are two men, Dr. Andrew Whitaker and Dr. Joseph Woods Brunson. They were very, very fine people, and they were good friends, and they were, above all, human beings who put the price of life above the fees that they could charge or whatever aggrandizement they would give, because that's when medicine really used to be medicine in certain ways as far as attitudinal things are concerned.
Yeah, sort of, and the fact that it was real lends it a patina that fictional stories like Atticus Finch taking hickory nuts in exchange for working out the entailment can't touch, even though that story was real in terms of Harper Lee's actual father. But it was a different time and a different way of approaching the profession, because professions were professions and medical arts were medical arts that were steeped in ideas of humanity that I think are long gone, Jim, in notions of managed care.
Well, finally, and I'm going to go here, for these men, medicine was a way of life, not a way of just making a living at exorbitant prices. And that's about all I have to say.
Well, you got a note in from our buddy Steve, and he says, that's one of the finest veteran stories I've ever heard. I heard a lot of my grandpa in that story. Thanks, Jim. That's from Steve.
Well, Steve, I thank you for being so kind as to respond. And I called Quaker Cemetery today, and I found out where Dr. Whitaker's grave is. I haven't been there in a long time. And I hope I'll be able to go and at least put something of a remembrance on his grave. When Dr. Brunson died, of course, flags were sent from Congressman Ray Hall at my request to his family.
Very nice, Jim. Very
and I just said, thank you.
Well, have a good evening, Jim. Take care. Our buddy Jim. Dr. John with a question. Essex kamikaze attack. Dr. John apparently went and found it. Dear God, that photo. Your dad was there. Bob, how did he carry that? Mostly in a sort of stoic silence, John, although he would tell if I implored hard enough, he would tell stories. And I don't think I'm being disloyal in saying that on those rare occasions when he would drive the 11 dangerous miles to the Tennessee state line and get a case of beer and bring it home because he had a couple of days off and put it in the cooler. And about a six-pack in, he'd start telling it with a little more graphic detail. Or he'd talk about spending 72 continuous hours on fire control with a set of headphones that weighed about 15 pounds, clamping, as he said, on his head like a vice. And none of them did keep very good contact with their buddies from the war. Early on, when he was a young man, he did. He had one particular friend who lived in Cincinnati, Ohio, and back then the United States had functioning passenger rail, and it was no big deal to get on the train here and a few hours later getting off the train in Cincinnati and go to see Archie and take in some Reds games together. And it was a wildly unlikely friendship because, you know, city kid from Cincinnati, German boy, and my dad, Protestant, Scots-Irish, coal miner kid, and Archie being devoutly Roman Catholic. They kept up with each other very good, very well until their families began to take off, and then when my dad exited stage south for Alabama, not much more was heard beyond Christmas cards. Until one trip back up this way when we were passing through Lexington, Kentucky, and my father looked and said, "Margaret, I'm going to see Archie." Because you can stay on 75 in Lexington and find your way to Cincinnati, or get on 64 eastbound to West Virginia. And he stopped at a payphone and went and changed a bunch of dollar bills into coins and dug up Archie's phone number and called to declare, as he had in years past, "I'm on my way, Archie." And Archie's wife put him on the phone. And Archie said, "Ken, don't come. I got cancer. And I love you too much. And I think too much of our friendship for me to want you to see me this way." And so he never saw Archie again. God, I guess that was about 1973. The stuff that comes bubbling to the surface. Wow, some progressive political talk radio program, huh? But those are, Jim's realities, Jim's memories, mine, yours, all of ours. Odds are, if you don't have a mom or a dad who was, if you weren't in the service or your mom or dad wasn't, it's almost 100% odds that by the time you get back to granddad's, they were. So, if you want to share any of those memories, and sort of make it, because this is a family commune, the Horn family commune, if you want to put it out there for folks to consider, and maybe inspire them to share theirs, you're welcome to do so. And the number 304-658-3333. And on the Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn. Let's go back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Bob. How are you?
Hey, Bill.
Yeah, an interesting day. I'm old enough, so old, I remember buying Buddy Poppies in downtown Cleveland. On Armistice Day. And what they've done with the day that was supposed to be the day to mark the war to end all wars is to turn it into something, and I'm not dishonoring any veteran of the thing, because you know how I've made a study of the mess in so many different incarnations, you know. And the war to end all wars, huh?
Yeah, followed, as my buddy Paul put on my Facebook page, by the peace to end all peace.
Yep. There's a whole lot to it that I've heard, and I don't know whether it's what you hear is correct, because some historians write this, some historians write that, but what the English and French went after Germany economically, which helped to bring inflation up to a place where my grandmother went back to visit Germany that she had left in 1898 or 99 or sometime, that it took a bushel, a basket of money to buy a loaf of bread. And the most people don't realize that we call the Great Depression was worldwide.
Well, that's because, Bill, the American people, the people of the United States, I get real iffy about the word American, because you know what? Yeah. I know it would shock the teabaggers and the Republicans and whatnot half out of their tiny little minds, but Canadians and Mexicans are American people, too.
Well, I remember an old Walt Disney.
And Guatemalans and Brazilians and Peruvians and Bolivians and, right.
Walt Disney children's book, Donald Duck, he goes down to South America and travels. And it's exactly what you said. You know, the whole damn continental area here is, you know, could be called America.
But the fact of the matter is, just to go back to what you raised a moment ago, Bill, the fervor for punishing Germany was so profound. I said at the beginning of the program that you could very easily say that Georges Clemenceau and David Lloyd George were the midwives of the Third Reich. But to be fair about it, had those two espoused the kind of merciful peace that Woodrow Wilson was touting, they would have been lynched in their own countries.
Yeah.
Because of the fervent yearnings for retribution.
Yeah.
Which goes to you know, there's a reason that book that so many people think is holy has a line in it about vengeance is mine, saith the Lord.
Yeah.
Because if you go around doing vengeance on your on your own hook, if you hang out your vengeance shingle, it's going to bite you.
Yeah.
And vengeance is generally best left alone. I mean, my God, think about, and this is certainly far more modern, but think about the 1 million Iraqi children who died between the end of the first Bush War and the beginning of the second Bush War on Bill Clinton's watch simply because of sanctions.
Yeah.
Nobody machine gunned them. They just died for want of access to medicine, access to decent food, access to clean drinking water, because let's remember, during Bush War I, we had done what is considered under the laws of so-called civilized warfare, which is oxymoronic at best,
yeah,
moronically in total.
Well, civilized, yeah.
Let alone civilized. We had bombed the civilian infrastructure. And, you know, here's a hint, we did the same thing to the Serbs, too. We bombed their ability to have clean water. We bombed their ability to have electricity. You know, under Colin Powell's theory of total war.
Well, you know what that Serbian thing took my mind back to immediately, Bob? Immediately back to 1914. This idea of people, like when I tell people that the Austrians had a navy. You look at a map of Austria today and say, what do they have, Chris Crafts on the Danube or what, you know? But they did have a fleet that was based somewhere, maybe in Trieste or wherever, you know, that they ruled in those days. They had a Mediterranean fleet, a landlocked Austria. So much for every idea. But
well, and that's part of the reason that Germany winds up bearing the brunt of the punishment, is that the Austro-Hungarian Habsburg Empire had completely collapsed, so there wasn't much to punish there. That left,
yeah.
And remember, the Germans had sued for peace. The Germans had sued for peace prior to November of 1918, but the American position was that we would not trust any deal brokered with Germany as long as Germany was an autocratic state. And so the reason the armistice happens on November the 11th, 1918, in the 11th minute of the 11th hour of the 11th day of the reason that happens is because Kaiser Wilhelm had abdicated on November 10th.
Yep. And of course, you know who was in that beer hall attempt by Hitler to, you know, what was it, 28? Whenever he, at the Munich beer hall, who's standing alongside him? Ludendorff.
Yeah, sure.
You know, the old, and the German army thought they could control that guy. But it was the industrialists in Germany that helped put Hitler into power. The big money crowd, you know, here we go again.
Well, and the big money crowd were all for the first one, too. I mean, if you read, of course, Barbara Tuchman's magnificent Guns of August, you know, the German plan, you know, let the last soldier sweep the channel with his sleeve.
Wet his sleeve down. Yep.
Yeah. It was magnificent, and it was, you know, and it had that awe-inspiring German precision about it. It was clockwork.
The Schlieffen plan.
Von Schlieffen plan. But the problem was they couldn't fully execute it, because they had a little Russian problem, or at least what they perceived to be a Russian problem.
Yeah, the Three Cousins War, huh?
Yeah.
Jesus.
I mean, what a... Well...
You can't... You keep pointing at it, and I just don't know where we're going anymore, and... Like, I hear everybody, I hear every talk show guy on radio, if you see a veteran, shake his hand. Well, sure, because he was doing what he was told.
Right, and I'll run the contrary to that, Bill. I tell you what, I'm not going to shake anybody's hand, because my dad's gone, my uncle is gone, I've got another uncle who's still here, but, you know, a great uncle and an uncle who are in the dirt, and I can't shake their hands.
Well...
And frankly, I'm gonna take those people at their word who said that that whole thank you for your service thing is a load of yellow ribbon sticker on the back of your SUV malarkey.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear. You know, you say that to most people, they'll be on your ass because they don't understand it, they don't get it. Right now, your buddy Bill's having a bad night. He got a at 4 o'clock. I was handed an eviction notice because of that. Four inch by 8 inch burn I put in a carpet last week.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah. So I don't know where I'm going to move to or anything else at this point in time. And, you know.
Well, you've got a right to fight that, you know.
I do?
Yeah, you do.
How?
You don't have to take that laying down.
I'd like to move out of here tomorrow if I could.
Sure. Like... And, you know, into one of those palatial estates by the lake, right?
Yeah. Same old, you know, these, it's going to get worse as the number of people over 65 increases. The so-called golden age is going to come, the golden egg, and you're going to have the yolk broken all over your forehead. Because when the number of people, because I'm on the tip of the iceberg, being born in 43, you know, mid-war baby, how many of those weren't there? Jim talking about the doctor. Yeah, the family doctor who delivered me held me up until 1 second after midnight. And as soon as he got the word that it was a new year, that's when the cord was cut. So I was the first baby in the area that year. Whoopee. And his assistant, his young doctor was in, January 1st of 43. He was probably in a medical hospital either in Italy or probably in North Africa, you know.
Yeah.
That's where the younger doctors were all. Yeah. I just finished the book, Ghost Soldiers, on the rescue of the last couple hundred POWs from Cabanatuan in the Philippines. And that was a good piece of work by some rangers. And they had about 200 Filipino guerrillas who had to hold this bridge to prevent the Japanese from reinforcing. And these guerrillas were not yet free citizens themselves. A couple hundred of them held up the Japanese pretty well. And they were able to, they put those POWs in carts driven by caribou and got them that far. And God knows how many men who were captured on Corregidor. I have a hard time with the Japanese medical unit and the Japanese military. They were as crazy as bedbugs, without a doubt, you know. Because they would... Did you ever read on the Pacific? It was a big seller in 75. I have it written down, but the Japanese military, the emperor recorded surrender things to the people.
We must endure the unendurable.
Yeah, and the Japanese military were trying to get those records, those recordings, and they would fight to the last drop of your blood or anybody else's. They didn't care. It was just insane, that kind of... John Toland was the author of the book I'm thinking of, and it was a big, huge seller in the 70s. And he ended up marrying the woman who was his interpreter, you know. And I met, I used to see and meet a lot of Japanese businessmen when you're playing on the University Circle campus, you know.
Sure.
A lot of these folks would come in. In fact, right now there are more, I don't know, I think there's more Asians. You know, that old word Oriental almost comes into mind. Where the hell does that come from? Do you know anything about that?
Well, yeah, that's Latin.
Okay.
Occident, Orient, West, okay. East.
So it's not an insulting term.
It's insulting within the context of the fact that it's also a term that's freighted with colonialism.
Well,
because, you know, I think we can agree that colonialism is uniformly a bad thing and never a good one.
Oh, yeah. And that was the whole, Germany and the U.S. fleet faced off in 1899 and at least didn't come to shooting. But the Germans wanted the Philippine Islands. Which is something I...
Well, the Germans desperately wanted... They were largely being left out of the colonial game.
Yeah.
And you got... Remember, before there was a Kaiser Wilhelm II, there was a Kaiser Wilhelm I, and it's all the same stupid family.
Well, the name of that
and so, you know, you show up at the family reunion cricket tournament, and, you know, there's some guy with his nose in the air saying, well, you know, we've got a new colony. How about you? I do not have any colonies. Ha, ha, ha. Oh, look at Willie over there. He hasn't any colonies. Poor Willie.
Yeah. Well, that book was The Rising Sun by Toland, which was
okay.
A stellar. And of course, we come back to that German beer that they started brewing when they leased Tsingtao from the Chinese Empress, you know, because she had a price on it. And Bob, what do you know about the Opium Wars?
Not nearly as much as I should, but I know enough to know that capitalism, baby, that it was a war to make sure that the opium trade stayed open to the West when the Chinese were rather interested in shutting it down.
Yeah, that was the whole thing is nothing. It's nothing new. I mean,
kind of takes that whole Charlton Heston and the Boxer Rebellion thing right out of it. No.
Yeah, that was, when I first read about it, and of course the movie. Did you ever see the movie of that?
Yeah.
Jesus.
What was it? No, it wasn't the Sand Pebbles, was it?
No, Sand Pebbles was a good movie. It really.
That was Steve McQueen.
Yeah, that was Steve McQueen and Candace Bergen, and the book was written by a guy who had been a gunboat sailor, and I try to tell people, look, imagine this. if you live on the Ohio River, Mississippi, Missouri, anything wide enough to float ships and deep enough.
55 days at Peking.
Yeah, that was the 55
the
days.
The terrible Charlton Heston movie.
But this idea of these gunboats sailing up and down, oh, they were protecting the missionaries, not to mention the business investments. And
well, think about the background, Bill, to, and you know, it's there in the background. It's not quite so overt. But think about the background to the story of Anna and the King of Siam, which later becomes The King and I.
Yeah.
For which we remember Yul Brynner shouting rapturously around the ballroom, ha-ha, during the Shall We Dance production number. Well, the background to that was the attempt of the British Empire colonialists trying to get their hooks into Thailand because the French had their hooks in Vietnam.
Yeah. That's what's so funny. I was down at a Vietnamese restaurant last week and walked next door to a Vietnamese delicatessen and buy four cans of Café Du Monde, you know. Talk about how culture...
That's living. That's living. Hey, I want to take you back to this eviction business real quick.
Yeah.
Please call legal aid tomorrow.
Yeah, I'll try to.
Barring that, you can call, I would imagine, the State Bar of Ohio, and I'll bet you they've got a pro bono lawyer referral service.
Yeah. Well, I used to have a pretty good friend here in whose home office was in Lakewood, and he's been a pretty good friend to you. His first name is Dennis.
Yeah.
Dennis and I worked together. He had just lost a run for council, and I was, geez, was I 24 maybe? Or younger than that, maybe 22. We both worked for Dow Jones. He was a copy reader. And then when my one friend left, Dennis became the slot man, if you know what the slot man is in a newspaper. The head copy reader.
Yeah.
And he was a good guy to work with, and he's been helpful to me. But, you know, what happened to me is my health aid is forever emptying ashtrays. And she's got me into the habit, and I dumped one with a hot ash. And I was gone for about 8 minutes. And the smoke, I stop at the sink, grab two things of water, come over and pour them on and call the fire department with the other hand, you know, so... I'm not worried about senility. And for a guy who's got bad eyes, and they complained about the number of power boxes I have, which are all fused. How unsafe are those things, Bob? Especially when you don't have anything pulling power out of them.
They're not unsafe.
I didn't think so either. So I don't know what I'm going to do. I know what I'd like to do with this building.
Nah, don't say that, Agent Fred says.
Yeah, I could walk in there and clean house years ago. But gone are the days for me and that kind of stuff. You know, I never thought I'd see this. Because my first wife and I were together 10 years. I moved just 11 times. I used to own my own appliance, Dolly. I had a couple of neighbors in one place. The woman was mad at her husband. She sold me her refrigerator, Dolly, for $20. That's a pretty good buy, you know. So I used to move everything, but those days are gone. And what killed us in Cleveland is we had a group of buses called Neighborhood Circulators. And you could get anywhere from here. I knew when the bus left, and I'd wait at most 5 minutes for another one and go all around Lakewood to any store I needed to go to, and they took those off. They're killing the transit systems.
Well, right, because because this country is in the grips of people who think that we can't afford that, but we can afford to build Tomahawk cruise missiles, i.e. a lot of lessons still unlearned. Something I heard on the radio this afternoon, Bill, that kind of... It's sort of similar to that. The same country that cannot afford to run a circulator bus in a Cleveland neighborhood also cannot afford... Well, okay, backing up. You know, anytime a hurricane approaches the American coastline, whether it be the Gulf Coast or the Atlantic seaboard, we send out planes full of very brave scientists who fly into the damn things. And, you know, I can't stand a bump in a turboprop or I start getting ready to vomit. Never mind. To get airspeed, direction, you know, every conceivable shred and scrap of data that we can out of that thing so that we can try to issue appropriate warnings to the people that the thing is bearing down on. Well, what I heard listening to National Petroleum Radio this afternoon was that we don't really know how strong Typhoon Haiyan was because nobody flew any planes into it to find out why. Now, my immediate thought was, that must be because of just how damn dangerous that thing was. No, it was apparently no more dangerous than flying into any other hurricane of similar magnitude. And we fly into those. No, it was deemed... we used to fly into them, into Pacific typhoons, except, and this is what I found shocking, decades ago, Bill, they were doing such, it was determined to be just too expensive. So we can fly into hurricanes to make sure that pastel-painted third or fourth or fifth vacation homes along some sort of gentrified coast where people have been bought out of their own coastal living, and I mean that's for real too. I was talking with Jim, I guess Friday night, about Kiowa Island. Well, that used to just be a wild spot with a few houses on it. Or you go a little further south into Georgia, there are people being, and of course naturally, they are people with high melanin contents in their skin,
yep,
who are being dispossessed of their home on what is deemed to be some high-value real estate now that they've been living on, by the way, for 300 years, because the county has come up with a real neat dodge where they jack up their property taxes so that they have to sell and get out, and they sell on the cheap to developers who then put up the pastel-painted second or third or fourth, 1% vacation homes. Wow. And so we will spend money to send planes into hurricanes to find out which vacation homes that never should have been built there in the first place are threatened. But if it comes to finding out what the actual data are about a monster typhoon bearing down on Lady Gulf, no, that's been outside the realm of our budgetary will for, in the words of National Petroleum Radio, decades.
Well, Katrina,
it's those people, right, Bill?
Well, yeah, of course it's those people. Yeah. It comes down to the fact of big money. Katrina, if I read a book on it, it hit the spoken books pretty quick. And I had to put it down, and I've got a strong stomach, but there's limits. And if I'm not mistaken, didn't Pontchartrain have something to do with that? The big lake that overlooks New Orleans?
How do you mean?
Isn't that where some of the water came from that buried that Ninth Ward?
Yeah. I believe. Well, it happened when the levee broke.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that was the levee, because Pontchartrain has been there for so long, of course. It's a natural lake, I guess. And in fact, there's a Dixieland piece called Millenburg Joys, Millenburg. Which was a big amusement park up there on Pontchartrain in the turn of the 19th century. And, of course, most Americans have no concept of the floods on the Ohio, Missouri, and Mississippi just prior to the Depression.
Oh, no. You mean when Hoover had the dark-skinned people chained together to try to hold back the floodwaters?
Well, there was one island in the Mississippi where they had herded all the working class people with a little more melatonin.
Yeah.
And they had them sitting on that island during these floods. That was the famous Cincinnati Reds picture where the guys had a rowboat and they had a photograph of the guys rowing around the bases. That's how high, because Crosley Field was pretty close to Ohio River, was it not?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember because, I think I had, unfortunately, I gave away a ton of books to my daughter. I had a daughter with a woman who wouldn't marry me because she was too rich. And she discovered me when I was 50 years old. But she got so, lose the job, lose the car, you know, the standard operating system, and then lose her mind. And she suicided, and she'd sit here with me, and she's quoting John the Idiot at me, you know. So that's depression, because she was
all eat up in that Revelation stuff?
Yep, she was as religious as I was, and, you know, I was raised, I had 4 years where the nuns were the bosses, you know. And, in fact, the place I was at, they just arrested one of the house parents. I don't know where they're getting them now. Whether these people have any degrees in sociology or anything at all, or just needed a job. But this guy was setting up dates for a 13-year-old girl. And they caught him. And I've got the rope if they want to borrow it, you know. People like that. And then another thing, we just had, there was 10 heroin arrests last week. On a city that's on the border.
Hey, and we know who we've got to thank for the upswing in heroin in the United States, don't we?
Oh, you think it has anything to do with the war in Afghanistan where the poppy grows?
Where the poppy wasn't growing until 2003.
Yeah. Yeah, the religious guys over there, they were funny. They weren't profiteering from something like the poppy. And
We even gave them, what, $23 million or so?
Yeah.
In 2001.
I know Uncle Ho was selling heroin to raise money for his war, and everybody does what they have to. And, you know, Jeff just died not long ago.
Yeah.
And he was so critical of what his country had become. How much did...
Oh, wholly owned subsidiary of Nike?
Yeah. Because there's so many things that have happened. Hell, in this city here, we had an elementary school fire where the doors opened in. And after that, of course, you know, I was talking to some. Remember the big fire they had in a clothing factory in Pakistan?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
What is it, Bangladesh? That side of it was east and west Pakistan at one time, if my memory is correct. And then he changed Bangladesh. And how about the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire?
Yeah, and one after another after another after. And that's part of why I said what I said regarding the First World War. Part of the reason you get the labor unrest that you get in the late teens and early 20s is because these were people who had been sent overseas. Told that they were making the world, I mean, you know, they were sent to Woodrow Wilson, they were making the world safe for democracy, right? And they came back to find out that the world was safe for democracy somewhere else, but they, by God, had better put their shoulders back to the wheel and quit complaining.
And wasn't Wilson in pretty bad shape when all that was going on?
Wilson got into bad shape after coming back from Europe when he went on the national tour to pitch the League of Nations idea, which had been scuttled by Henry Cabot Lodge, because Henry Cabot Lodge was a venal, filthy little Republican who felt like Woodrow Wilson had snubbed him by not consulting with him first. Think Ted Cruz with an up east accent.
Well, we've got a big thing coming up this month.
Only not as religiously crazy as Ted Cruz, maybe.
See, we've got that Dallas situation coming up. And, Bob, there's nothing like sitting down with your Sunday paper, sitting in an easy chair, and there, Lee Harvey Oswald's coming out being transferred, and some guy comes out of nowhere and shoots him. It's like, I still don't buy it.
No, there's so much there not to buy.
Yeah, I always said, poor John Kennedy, he had a list of people who didn't like him that was pretty... Well, what I heard, one of the lines I heard the day the shooting took place was that some guy said the bullet came from Arizona, meaning Goldwater. So that's how sick the sense of humor is in this country, you know, that somebody can pop up with a one-liner like that. I said, oh, my God. Well, I won't keep people off the phone, but, yeah, today is a day that I remember quite... In fact, one of my cousins has a birthday today, but I called her last Saturday. So one of the few remaining relatives I have left. And it meant a lot to the guy selling poppies downtown Cleveland in 19... I was 54, so I bet some of them were still vets of World War One at that point in time. Anyway, you take care of yourself.
All right, Bill. You've got an email from Tim in your box now.
Yeah.
Who wants to reach out and try to offer some help or somebody you can consult with?
Yeah.
And then again, two calls: legal aid tomorrow, and call the state bar and ask if they have a pro bono referral project.
Yeah.
Those two things. And by the way, Kevin dropped a note and he said, "Please pass on to Mr. Stress that I, for some reason, cannot send to him." So. I don't know what's going on there.
Coming through, I think one of my computer experts is a strong family member, and he'll figure that one out for me.
Okay, Bill, don't let it eat your belly up, and you don't eat your own liver, all right?
It's killing me, because I'll tell you what, Bob, when they handed me that, I thought the office was closed today because of the holiday.
Mm-hmm.
To knock at the door about between 4 and 4:30. Well, you can't call anybody at that time. Because everybody's closed today anyway. Why do these social service agencies get this off as a day off? What?
Well, because it's supposed to be a national day of remembrance.
Yeah.
But Walmart was open.
Yeah. Well, I hope they remember what they needed at Walmart, you know? Because I have not liked this place that much since they killed the circulator buses. Every place you go, you are isolated when you can no longer drive. And the hours I spent underneath cars making sure I could still drive really eat me alive to this day. Well, my buddy called me from Arizona, the guy that recorded that Stress Live at the Euclid album. He lives out by one of the parks, and he just shot his second rattler in the house the other day. So things can be tougher, you know. But he uses a .22. And they actually sell a type of ammunition down there. For snakes of some kind, the way he describes it to me. And he's a great guy to begin with. He's rebuilding the front entrance to what had been a copper mine. And it's all this wrought iron, and, of course, they didn't weld in 1870 or 80. So it's all fasteners, and he has to cut the metal out. And the guy's 66, but he's a... One of those guys, he said, he says, Bill, the problem that you never had and that I had, he was dyslexic when it came to reading. But he always tells me, you're the best backyard mechanic I ever saw. So I appreciate that. Anyway, you take care.
All right, Bill, you have a good night.
Good night now.
Bye now. Our buddy Mr. Stress calling from Cleveland. I need to get some thanks out there. Thanks to Gary. Gary just took care of half of tonight's fundraising. Thank you very much, Gary. That is the one and only response we've received this evening, so I thank you very, very kindly. Hopefully that'll prove a bit of incentive. Head on RadioNetwork.com, and that's where you'll find either the traditional mail address or the PayPal button. By the way, I can report that Boss Man Wayne has happily told me that he has been met with something besides an echo inside the mailbox of late. So thank you very much. Back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello.
This is Edward.
Hey, Edward, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
I'm pretty good, I think.
Well, I have a World War One story to tell you.
Oh, good.
There was this lady, and she told me this story herself. in her younger days, she had absolutely flaming red hair and one of those peaches and cream complexions. And she was walking down Railroad Street. This was during World War One, and she was walking down Railroad Street, and she heard this train coming, and she turned around and looked, and, of course, we all knew the train schedule. There was no train supposed to be coming through there that time of day. And she saw these guys hanging out the windows and waving their arms and yelling. And she was wearing a white dress trimmed in blue. And the train came through town, and the boys spied her. And they all hung out the windows and started singing, "Hooray for the red, white, and blue."
I'll be darned.
Yep. She told me that story herself.
Wow. Very nice story.
Well, I think it is. And she was a nice lady, too. She was also very pretty, even as an elderly lady. Well, you take care and have a good week.
I will certainly try. I'm awfully glad you called, Edward.
Thank you.
You have a good evening.
I will.
Bye now. Our buddy Edward calling from Dallas, 304-658-3333 is the number. On Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn is the number. And since we talked about the Espionage Act of 1917 and talked about notions of censorship and good speech and bad speech, something interesting happened in Arkansas over the weekend. You know, during the week, the comic strip is monochrome and short and small, and newspapers pump a bunch of money into printing up shiny Sunday funnies, full color, you know, the works. Enter stage right the Arkansas ironically named Democrat Gazette, who runs Doonesbury. Well, Doonesbury's Sunday panel in the Arkansas Democrat Gazette was a rerun from years back. Maybe it was Zonker Harris talking to a pot plant or something. It was not, however, the panels that Gary Trudeau had created for yesterday, which simply featured a man with thought bubbles holding a cup of coffee. Time to take a stand, no matter what the cost. A little yellow box that says Dark Days. The man says to his boy, "The founding framers would puke, son. They formed our government to protect individual rights, not give them away to people who don't deserve them. We're living in a tyranny now. Washington telling us what we can and can't do, while a dictator with total contempt for our values sits in the White House. Well, it's time to fight back. We may be in the minority, but God is on our side." And then the next little yellow box in the final panel says, "In 1861. And the dad's talking to his son and says, "Give him hell, boy." "I will, sir," says the son, dressed in butternut. And that was spiked by the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, because we can't be telling the Confederates that they was wrong. Holy mackerel. So I guess that's a way, at 10 minutes before the hour of 8 p.m. here in the Eastern Standard Time Zone, of saying that, yeah, I recognize it's still Moran Monday, and our first nominees are the editorial board or whoever it is that makes such decisions at the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, who spikes the Sunday funnies because it's too strong a medicine for their teabagging readers to cogitate upon, and does this only a week after Senator Tail Gunner Ted Cruz tells Barack Obama that he had better, by God, leave Texas, less than 3 weeks before the 50th anniversary of another Democratic president who was told not to come to, by God, Texas? Meanwhile, in Texas... thank you, Fritz. A little bit of an update there. Fritz is in Arkansas, of course. The Arkansas Democrat Gazette is notorious for censoring Doonesbury strips that are too controversial. This isn't the first time. No, but the irony on this one is thick enough to cut with a knife. A really dull one at that. And probably spread frosting of it. Thanks very much. Oh, hey, wow. Thank you, Edward. Edward joining in with Gary this evening to put us only $50 away from meeting tonight's fundraising goal. Thank you, Edward. Thank you very much. There are bills awaiting to be paid. So now, I think we can take a run and start at one of them. Or two, or three, or however many I pull out of the hat before the money's all gone. Yeah, can't be telling them Arkansans about 1861. Because they still think it was a noble lost cause. By the way, a note coming in a little while back from John. He said, tonight, you just sort of demeaned tonight's program, some progressive political talk radio, huh? And I said that, I really did. But I guess in my own defense, I was saying that about my own maunderings about things that I learned along the way. Not y'all. But Dr. John says, don't you dare. This has been incredible. There's nothing like this available anywhere tonight. Hearing Jim talk about his father and the doctor, your recollections about your dad, Bill's contributions, the emails you've read from Mark and Betsy and the man who was in Vietnam, that was Rob, and we're just a third of the way in. This, says Dr. John, is patriotism. Looking at our own history and thinking about what it means. Not right-wing, my way or the highway, false patriotism. The idea that veterans deserve respect when they come home and that a perfect world will not have any need for veterans because it won't need militaries. That's radical in both senses of the word. Thank you, John. Thank you very much. And I guess I just worry sometimes about me boring y'all with my stories, not yours, but mine. Because Jim also pointed out, I cannot think of anything more progressive than remembering those who touched our lives. And you're both right. You're both absolutely right. As far as the ongoing exploits of the Morans in Moran Monday, so in Arkansas, we can't be reminding the people of that state that they are the great 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 multi great grandsons and granddaughters of people who committed treason. Oh no, we can't do that. That might hurt advertising rates. But meanwhile, in Texas, oh yes. Meanwhile in Texas, Jesus. Two things. One being an 18th birthday party in Texas, in which said birthday was celebrated near Houston in a home with a couple of folks going outside and shooting their freedom-protecting Wolverines shooting guns up into the air. Late Saturday night in the Cypress area of Harris County, Texas. About 100 people were attending the 18-year-old's birthday. So then when people heard the gunfire, they started running, trying to get the hell away. Some people were trampled. Some people got critical injuries. Some people got minor injuries. Well, by the time all the shooting was done, because a couple of geniuses then turned around and decided to protect freedom by shooting into the crowd, when all was said and done, two were dead and dozens of people were hurt. According to News Channel 5, Young people then streamed into the narrow street to avoid the burst of gunshots that followed shortly before 11 p.m. Saturday. 16 people suffered gunshot wounds. Not to mention fractured bones, twisted ankles during the stampede. The two dead, an 18-year-old male and a 16-year-old female from Cypress Springs High School. The party had been bruited on Facebook. Come one, come all who walk or crawl. Yeah. Harris County Sheriff Adrian Garcia said, it's a horrible combination of immaturity, access to a firearm, and the inability to control one's self. I don't know if Sheriff Garcia was necessarily thinking in order there, but I really have to think ease of access to firearm has to be higher on the list than immaturity. Maybe that's a philosophical debate. I don't know. They even had a bouncer at the party. According to News Channel 5, Mariah Bolden said the gathering was her birthday party. She said her brother and others were patting down people as they entered the home. Two men refused to be searched and walked away, and then apparently hopped a neighbor's fence and entered through a back gate. Mariah Bolden said, they wasn't supposed to be here, whoever they are, or whoever they was, excuse me. Because freedom. Also from Texas. This happened yesterday. In the Dallas, Texas Metroplex area. You know there's an organization out there called Moms Demand Action. It's a group of moms who demand action regarding easy access to firearms, see Cypress Springs, Harris County, Texas, above. So they were getting together. I think there were four of them. Four moms. They were getting together at a restaurant to sit down and talk about what they were going to do next in their campaign of being moms who were going to demand action about firearms. This is probably as good a place as any to note that Texas is one of six states, which kind of blows my mind, is one of only six states in which the open carry of firearms is not legal. Now, you can concealed carry, and you can go and get a concealed carry permit, but you can't strap on and just march down the middle of Main Street with your Freedom Protecting Penile Enhancement and show everybody what a patriotic merkin you are. Wolverines! Can't do that in Texas. So somehow or another, word got out that the moms who were demanding action were going to be sitting and having lunch on a Sunday in Texas, somewhere in the Dallas area. And while I know only somewhere in the Dallas area, it apparently was known with specificity where they were going to be. Some little chain restaurant somewhere, I'm sure. So that is when about 40 people, men, women, and yes, children, And by children, I mean from the photograph that I'm looking at, like 6 and 7 year olds descended upon this place of business and literally set up an ambush. And they did so openly carrying their firearms in flagrant contravention of the law of the state of Texas. Because we can't have four moms who think that their children are not worthwhile blood sacrifices for the weird gun lusts of a bunch of gun goons. We can't have them meeting in peace. By God, they've got to be intimidated into not meeting at all. I mean, what do they think this is, America? By God, this is Texas. So they knelt down and they held their guns out, and the, you know, protecting freedom and all, and they waited there in the parking lot until one of the women looked. Well, my word, Blanche, there's a bunch of gun goons outside laying an ambush for us. So then they told the restaurant management, there's a bunch of gun goons out there openly carrying weapons on the parking lot of the mall or whatever, just because we're in here having lunch. That's illegal. We don't have open carry in the state of Texas. And somebody there in the restaurant got hold of corporate being in this case the manager, who said, I'm not going to call 911. I don't want to set off a riot. What? No, really. They pulled up in the parking lot and started getting guns out of their trunks. And the restaurant manager did not want to call 911 for fear of inciting a riot and waited for the gun advocates to leave. I mean, it's kind of like you're in that old mission church in San Antonio, and the entire Mexican army comes up, and Colonel Travis inside says, yeah, I don't want to call for reinforcements. That Santa Ana, he might riot. Look at them guns! Okay, it's not an entirely apt analogy, but, well, you know. So to review, the law says no open carry in Texas, but 40 goons, I mean, F Godwin's law, 40 brown shirts show up outside Ruby Tuesdays or who the hell evers because they want to intimidate some mothers into shutting up about talking about firearms. So the four women were trapped in the restaurant for 2 hours until the gun goons finally figured that they had made their point and they put all their guns back in their trunks and then drove off to the Hooters. No shit. Drove off to the Hooters, where they then had photographs taken of them with the Hooters girls. Kid you not. All right, come on. We've defended freedom here. Them four women will think twice before they ever sit down to lunch to talk about demand and action again. Come on, let's go to Hooters. Beer's on me. And Cletus can get the wings. Damn it, I always have to get the wings. The wings is more expensive than the beer is. Yeah, but we're talking about patriotism, Cletus. Ain't you got no patriotism? Oh, F it. Wolverines. Come on, let's roll. So we've got a photograph, and it's gone around the interweb tubes with the hashtag gunbullies. And there's even one jackass in a red shirt with his Freedom Protector slung over his shoulder like he's getting ready to march off to Chickamauga or some such. and the stupid bastard is turned toward the camera, flexing his arms like he's some sort of damn gorilla just stood up from walking amongst his knuckles. I would think he would be identifiable, and I would think from the totality of the circumstances in the photograph that it would also be verifiable that these people were openly carrying weapons inside the state of Texas in contravention of the law of the state of Texas, which says thou may not. But again, I need to know, really I do, anybody, I need to know where it is that the moms who were demanding action were meeting. Let me dig a little deeper here and see if I can find that. Oh, yes, lo and behold, there it is, the name of the establishment. Would anybody care to do, and it won't cost you a damn thing, this is an outfit called the Blue Mesa Grill. And insofar as it looks like a mallish kind of place, I'm guessing the Blue Mesa Grill is probably a chain of some sort. There's probably three or four of them. Anybody want to do some quick research and find out what kind of a chain Blue Mesa Grill is? Because their corporate communications department needs a note or million saying, insofar as your manager at the Blue Mesa Grill somewhere in or around Dallas would not call 911 when a bunch of law-breaking gun-toters showed up to intimidate your patrons, nobody in their right mind would go to Blue Mesa Grill, and we shall advise our friends, our neighbors, our family, our church, our lodge, our bowling league, not to go to Blue Mesa Grill until such time as you issue a very clear statement that you will not sit still while people with guns intimidate your customers. This is not rocket science. No. They were literally waiting for the four women of Moms Demand Action to come out so that they could, what? We don't know. Scream at them? Shoot them in cold blood? Who knows with these freedom-protecting patriots? Gotta lead them a little bit, Cletus! But what's more, these gun goons have a history of this. They've done it in Indianapolis. And last December, these gun goons are going to go to the blood-sodden ground of Sandy Hook Elementary carrying their guns. Because their rights are more important than the ability of a 6-year-old to be a 7-year-old. Okay, point taken. Jay pointing out, Texas cops, not calling 911, kept a larger bunch of gun-toting bubbas from responding. Hell, maybe they would have arrested the moms demanding action. Still, I mean, the gun-toting bubbas are required by law to enforce the laws of the state of Texas, are they not? I mean, granted, nobody got arrested in San Antonio, and apparently nobody gets arrested in Dallas, so I guess they're just trying to de facto abrogate the law by lack of enforcement. Well, I mean, if the Supreme Court can tell us we can't enforce our anti-sodomy laws, why should we have to enforce our anti-freedom protecting open carry laws neither? Is that how it works? Thank you, Tim. Blue Mesa Grill is to be found at Addison Preston Pond 2 in Addison, Texas, in Arlington at Lincoln Square, in Dallas at Lincoln Park, in Fort Worth at University Park Village, in North Plano at Granite Park, And somewhere along the way, they've got to have a corporate headquarters where we can reach out to them and inform them that we just don't find putting women under siege with a bunch of freedom-protecting gun goons to be good corporate policy. That if they want to invite all the gun goons in, then all the normal people can then leave, and we'll just find out who's got more business weight. It's Texas. No, bullshit. I am not going to say that. No, that was mean. I've been there. I've met progressives in Texas. I know how many millions of them there are. And I'm thinking, just maybe, there's enough people to make a difference. Our street tacos platter is now benefiting our local charities. These platters of three tacos on homemade flour or corn tortillas give you a choice to mix and match fillings as you like. Choose from chicken, steak, shrimp, portobello mushrooms, barbecue, pulled pork, plus a choice of two side dishes. 50 cents of every street taco platter sold is donated to Bale Dan, Hope Lodge, Lena Pope Home, Operation Kindness, Casa of Collin County, and United Way of Tarrant County. Because of the popularity of these tacos, we're sure our charitable contribution will be greater than ever. We're especially grateful to all of you who have helped us support charities that really make a difference in people's lives. And it's a pretty impressive list of charities. Bale Don is Hindi. It means child donation. It's a nonprofit that helps children in need in India. Casa of Collin County is an organization that provides well-trained volunteers to advocate for children so severely abused or neglected they're removed from their homes. Hope Lodge is an effort of the American Cancer Society in Lubbock, and it provides free lodging to cancer patients and caregivers who have to travel to Lubbock to receive cancer care. The Lena Pope Home is a future of hope for all children and their families by offering preventive and rehabilitative services that strengthen and preserve family life by helping them make healing changes that can transform their futures. Operation Kindness was founded in 1976. It's the oldest and largest no-kill animal shelter in North Texas. The irony is about to sucker punch me. So you got a bunch of children's charities and a no-kill animal shelter that is supported by charitable donations, and people go to the place that does the charitable donations. This probably has an impact on sales. I mean, individuals do charity because of their own personal philosophies. Corporations do charities because, A, they get to write it off on their taxes, and B, it's good for business. So who knows? Maybe Moms Demand Action went to Blue Mesa Grill because they knew that they did good work. And then they find themselves besieged by a bunch of gun goons. Blue Mesa Grill going to have to sort this out. Tacos for a cause. Damn, I'm hungry now. Wow. Texas Betsy pointing out Cassie's advocate when she was 17 came from CASA. I've worked with them for other kids. So it must be a good organization. I wonder how CASA, Bale Don, Hope Lodge, Lena Pope Home, Operation Kindness feel about being associated with a corporation that will not run off a bunch of goddamn gun goons who are laying siege to their place of business because they don't like the fact that four women are having lunch there. BlueMesaGrill.com is their home page. You can probably find the contact information there. Sergi with a note, he says, I've been to the Blue Mesa over there on University Drive here in Fort Worth. I'd rather have my homie's cornbread jello surprise than eat that crap again. It's the shittiest Mexican food I've ever had in my life. Signed, Sergi, Taco Bell is a 5-star joint compared to this place, Kyle. Wow. Then again, y'all down in Texas get kind of snitty about the quality of your Tex-Mex, and I understand that. Because just hearing the words Taco Bell makes my liver quiver. Blue Mesa headquarters is at 77 West North Highway 7, West Northwest Highway 740. A lot of creativity in that highway name. 7700 West Northwest Highway number 740, Dallas, Texas 75254. Their phone, by the way, is area code 204-378-8686, and they are apparently owned by someone by the name of Liz Barron. Our manager wouldn't call the police because she was afraid that it would incite a riot. Yeah, don't call the police or the people with the guns are going to get upset. Huh. Didn't quite work out that way over in the over outside Waco with that whole Branch Davidian thing, did it? Not that I'm defending David Koresh. No. Now I'll get letters about that. Hey, thanks. Thanks to David. David jumped in. We are now $25 away from being done with fundraising. Thank you very much, David. It's much, much appreciated. Tremendously appreciated. That's a little more bill paying we can do. Thank you. Thank you very much, David. To the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob, I've got a message for Bill, Dr. Stress.
Sure.
Okay, here's a number. And I know enough about government to know that you have a process of appeals and you have to go up the chain of command. But here the number is. If you give it to him, or if he's listening with the sound of my voice, then if he has a pen handy, or if you've got one handy to send to him.
Okay, hang on. Let me get something up here where I can take it down. Because...
And you're free to give him my email address if he needs any other help.
Okay, area code and phone number, please.
Okay, you're talking about the Office of Hearings and Appeals, U.S. Department of Housing, and this is HUD Section 8, and the number is 202-705,
mm-hmm.
Or as you were, 708.
Okay.
708-1455.
And that's HUD?
That's right. That's
Section 8.
Right. That, I assume that's the type of housing he has. But it's the Office of Appeals and Hearings.
Okay, I'm typing with one finger.
Okay, no problem. But, I mean, you know, the manager of that place doesn't have the last word in this. And through, you know, explanation and whatever, and the fact that he reacted properly in summoning help proves, number one, that he's in control of his faculties. Number two, he realized the immediacy of the situation. And number three, doesn't need to be thrown out on his ass.
Amen to that, on all counts.
So,
well, thank you, Jim. Thank you for doing that piece of research.
202-708-1455.
I've got it right here.
And he may get a lot of people to pass him on, but he just needs to be patient. And he also needs to involve his local congressman. Because, I mean, these people who are running these places, they get significant amounts of money from the federal government and subsidies for people who rent there, and they have rights to.
Hear, hear. Absolutely.
So I didn't mean to interrupt your program again.
Oh, no, no, no. That's the kind of work that happens inside this family, and we are grateful for it, Jim.
Well, like I say, I spent part of my career trying to help people, and, you know, when they... I would tell them, I'm for the federal government, and I'm here to help you. That wasn't bullshit. I meant it.
Yeah.
Took care of a lot of soldiers, buddy.
Well, I don't doubt it in the least. And that, you know, you use that phrase, and it reminds me of what an obnoxious disservice it was to everybody who's ever done civil service in this country when that greasy-haired old C-movie actor Ronald Reagan used it as a point of derision.
Well, I'm not going to get into what I think about him and that, but when you take or raise your right hand and you take that oath, whether you're in uniform or out of uniform, I don't know what it meant to him, but it meant a hell of a lot to me, and that was to do whatever I could to ameliorate a situation and not exacerbate a situation just because I had a little power in my hand.
Yeah, you know, we've got a friend of the program who works. I mean, and you've heard others who worked in various parts of the civil service. There's one I can think of who is active in the Social Security Administration, and is motivated by nothing but a desire to help people. And that's, I think that's one of the things that really crawls, I mean, just gets right up under my skin when I hear Republicans talking about the idea of government being some sort of negative.
Well, they've lost the entire prospect of government, because government is designed to do collectively for the group what an individual cannot do for himself. And it's designed to help, not to hurt.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's designed to provide comfort, not the other. And, you know, I just wanted to pass that on, and I'm going to get off here and let you continue your program.
All right. Thank you, Jim.
Good night.
Bye now. Jim, doing a little bit of community outreach there. Isn't that cool? And so, Bill, if you didn't catch the number, shoot me an email. I'll send you one after the program if you need, and provide you with that information. Continuing on the phones, 304-658-3333 is the number. On Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn. Either way is fine by me. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello, Bob.
Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Well, I'm just thinking about this thing that Bill was talking about, and I'm wondering how much notice they gave him, too. I would hope it would be 30 days. But knowing how some of these people work, it could be as little as a week. Or my place here used to love to put a 3-day notice on people's doors, which, of course, is totally illegal. But nonetheless, they preyed on the ignorance of others and, you know, that kind of thing. But I would hope they would have at least given him 30 days. So I'd be interested in that, and I think even agencies like the Area Agency on Aging, places like that locally, could be of help too.
I hope so. I don't know to what extent the laws of the state of Ohio have been perverted by right-wingery, quite honestly, Kevin. I don't know.
Yeah, that's always something to consider, but still, like Jim was saying, you know, the Section 8 housing and that, there's still laws that these places have got to follow, because they do get breaks from the government on taxes and things like that. Even for me, who's not on any sort of housing, they still get a break because I'm disabled. So, you know, they still have to follow basic tenant renter guidelines. And just because I have a fire in my apartment doesn't mean that you've got the right to evict me. You know, even if the fire were my fault, you know, accidents happen. That's why you carry things like renter's insurance, and that's why they carry insurance as well.
And that's why you also, as he did, go and put out the fire.
Right, exactly. And it just...
Well, I mean, that struck a nerve with me, because if this was not our very own beaten down, bedraggled 80-year-old pile of sticks here, I guess we would have been evicted several years ago, because I was doing some cooking, and I had a pot, I had an iron skillet that was way too hot, and damn near dropped it, and managed to just get it set nicely on the linoleum floor, and there's still a nice little melted ring of linoleum there.
Yeah,
you know, because, well, you know, look at Daddy. Hey, I burned the house down. Funny Daddy. Right?
Well,
and that, I mean, it was entirely my fault, but, you know, there wasn't no way I was going to throw something like that in the sink and then watch it all go kaboom.
Oh, yeah, sure. But that's why you got fire extinguishers, and that's why you got smoke alarms. And I'm sure even in Ohio nowadays, they're requiring smoke alarms in every apartment. My smoke alarm is so sensitive that if I cook on the stove, it goes off. You know, and you barely can light a cigarette in this house without it going off. I'm surprised it doesn't sometimes. I don't smoke, but my PCP does, and you know, I'm amazed when it doesn't go off, because it does once I heat the oven up. And I always have to run the fan on the smoke alarm because it's going off. So I, you know, if Bill was up to fire, you know, it's a funny thing too. They're complaining about him causing the fire or the fire being his fault, but what they don't say is that, well, Bill had enough common sense to put the fire out and call the fire department at the same time. And if Bill were not so inclined, he could have just said, I wouldn't even try to put the fire out. I'll call the fire department and go outside. And by that time, it might have been a real, you know, much worse fire. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But there's no thanks to Bill for, yeah, while he's on the phone with the fire department, he's also spraying out the fire with the fire extinguisher. You know. And that's the sad part. They want to look at the negative of it instead of the positive of it. And so I hope he can get some help there as far as, you know.
Well, you mentioned, bless your heart, bless everybody's heart. One of the wonderful things about the Horn family commune, Kevin, is that even in dark times, people can find a way for a smile. You mentioned that your smoke alarm goes off when you cook.
Yep.
Tim in the chat room, Tim from L.A., said, well, when my smoke alarms go off, it means the dinner's ready.
Well.
And then Lottie in the chat room noting, the smoke alarm used to be my mother's roast turkey timer. You put the turkey in?
Yeah.
When the smoke alarm goes off, turkey's done. Mmm, turkey.
Nope. One other thing you mentioned earlier today, Bob, you talked about the people who thank you for being a vet. And being a vet myself, I have two kinds of thank yous, and you could tell which one's which. The thank you for being a vet from someone that's a right-wing conservative is an entirely different thank you than someone that isn't. And the one that's from a right-wing conservative, you can tell. It's almost condescending. Whereas someone with common sense...
Or syrupy, maybe?
Yeah, that's the word. Thank you. That's exactly right. Syrupy.
God bless you. Thank you for your service.
You're right. And you can tell. So I don't get upset at everybody who thanks me for being a vet. The ones that are a little bit too syrupy with it, I totally ignore. And the ones that aren't, I accept it for what it is. And I think on Friday's show, Larry mentioned what's the common denominator with vets. He asked that question some sort of way, and I think how I would answer that is, no matter what the veteran, whether it's our great-grandparents on down to me, you share a common bond of knowing, if that's the right word, that you served, even in peacetime, you put yourself at risk for the country, as it were. I never served in wartime at all, but I know more than a few people that died serving in peacetime. And I know that I had a couple instances where I very easily could have been among them. And that's not saying anything about me. That's saying about the nature of the service. Jim talked about his Hell Week at the Citadel. Those kind of things. Because it's just like that bond that holds you, and I'm not being syrupy when I say that. We kind of know what we all have had to go through to get to be a veteran, I guess is a way to put it.
Yeah, and I'll say this right now. You know, of course, I didn't go in the military, but I did turn down an opportunity to go to Annapolis. And bless his heart, I think that deeply bothered my father, but he never gave me any hell about it. But I spend a lot of time wondering what would have happened, what that would have been.
Well, there is a lot of prestige in being an Annapolis grad or any service academy grad. But by the time you would have gone in service and done your 7 years as an officer, the benefits weren't there like they were for your father. You had the prestige of being an Annapolis grad, and that can get you places, but in the long run, probably no other place that you didn't get anyway, if that makes sense. And, yeah, I think you made the right choice, and that's based on my...
You know, that's funny. Every person I've ever known who was in the military told me that, has said the same thing. Nobody said, yeah. Wow, did you screw up?
No. Have a lot of respect for the people that served, but I couldn't tell anybody to go in. I just couldn't anymore. It's... For all the syrupy, thank you for being a military vet.
Well, you know, my son will soon be 18.
Yeah.
And it and how can I put this? If you live where I live, the military recruiters descend upon high schools like the one he attends like ducks on June bugs.
Oh yeah.
And apparently it's a, you know, it's a real compelling pitch.
Oh, yeah.
And he's thinking real, real hard about it. And I try to talk reality to him. That's all I can do. And he says things like, well, Dad, when the time comes, it won't be your decision.
Yep. Man.
And I have to acknowledge it to the same extent that my father did.
Yep.
Although I don't think there's any doubt my father would have been proud as punch.
Oh, yeah. Like I said, there's a lot of prestige in being an academy graduate. But there's also a lot of danger in being an academy graduate. You know what I'm saying? And I just... These people that want to thank you for being a vet are not the ones pushing for more benefits for military and veterans. They're the ones that are also pushing for less benefits for military and veterans. And that, you know, that's a lot of this that drives me in not saying I couldn't recommend anybody to go in. Now, if it were a wartime situation where our country was at risk, that would be different, but in this today's military, today's world, where the empire, you know, the empire mentality, no, I can't tell. If I had kids, I couldn't tell my own kids to go in. I wouldn't. And, you know, I hope, the best way to say it with Fergus, I hope he makes the right decision, but I also hope he makes an informed decision, not one based on, like I did when I went in. You know, there's a lot, when you're 18, there's a lot of starry-eyed wanderlust and adventure and all that. But, you know, and there are some pros and cons to it. If they offer him the possibility of paying for his college, you know, that kind of thing, and you know.
Yeah, but I've known too many guys who went in on that pay for college thing, and it doesn't quite work out the same the way that.
No, it doesn't. No. No. And the other thing I'd tell him too is, if you're going to go in as an officer, let them either pay for your college and then commit after you get out of college. You know, that kind of thing. Don't sell yourself short. you know, I know a lot of enlisted people are proud of being enlisted, but in thinking of someone's future, I want to see them go as far as they can, the best way they can. And I definitely would like to see him go to college, however he accomplishes that goal,
right,
before he went into the service, because you're right. That doesn't work out like they promise you. It never has. It never will. So, but.
And there's a lot of really respectable institutions of higher learning with various and sundry ROTC departments and all the scholarships that,
oh, yeah,
go with it. Recently, a friend of mine from down Bama way told me that I had no idea this is true, the largest corps of midshipmen outside the United States Naval Academy is at Auburn University.
Auburn?
Uh-huh.
Or Auburn?
Auburn. You know.
Yep. Yeah. The Iron Bowl's coming up this week.
You know what? That's going to be a dandy, too. You got a one-loss team versus a no-loss team.
I know. So, and I remember when the good old days when it was in Birmingham.
Legion Field, neutral turf. But Legion Field just got so old and so decrepit. And both schools poured a blue bajillion dollars into upgrading their stadiums. I mean, Jordan Hare is unbelievable, and Bryant Denny is probably not far behind. Of course, neither of them can even begin to touch the crowd capacity of, say, you know, UT in Knoxville. I mean, God, what does that thing hold? 109, 112, 116,000 people?
Yeah, and it's usually full, too.
Yeah, bad day for the Vols last Saturday. Oh, my God. 56-23, Auburn beat them.
Yeah, well, not as bad as my Florida Gators had last Saturday.
Yeah, you took it on the chin from Vandy, man.
Well, we're taking it on the chin from everybody this year, it seems like.
Oh, well, you didn't get it. But, you know, at least that thing was out of hand fairly early on. I had to wait all the way to the end of overtime to have my heart broken by the Mountaineers, Kevin.
Yeah.
47-40, Texas over the Mountaineers. I even got a lovely email from our buddy Fancy Free, who said, I'm sitting here watching my alma mater play the Mountaineers, and what a game. And it was. It was a Jim Dan. I mean, it was like watching a heavyweight prize fight.
Yep.
And bless their hearts, the Mountaineers played all the way out of their shoes. They just pulled up short.
They played, I think you described it earlier this year, snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. They've done that a couple times this year.
Our not the best quarterback in the world starting quarterback, who we now kind of understand why he left Florida State to come to West Virginia, because he was never going to start at Florida State. He got knocked out with his bell rung in the first quarter after five sacks.
Yep.
In the first quarter. And the second stringer came in and really put on a yeoman performance. The defense for West Virginia's defense had to stiffen inside the red zone five times because of West Virginia offense turnovers, and only gave up four field goals and one touchdown, which for five trips inside the red zone is not bad business.
No. Mm-mm. And particularly since it was Texas, too. So.
Yeah. By the way, Randy in PA just notes, playing football is like smoking hashish. You can't afford the lost brain cells. And more, that's turning out to be absolutely true.
You know, I don't understand it. With the technology both the NFL and college have, the investments they have in the players, you'd almost think they could develop. You'd think they could invent a helmet by now. Well, I mean, we are in 2013, that could stop a lot of those concussions, just like Kevlar spreads the shock out over, protects the ribs or whatever. You know, by taking that shock and spreading it out over an area, you'd think they could do that with a helmet by now. and yet players are still getting
but they're trying. Part of the problem is people, and this goes back to the origin of the helmet. You know, when helmets were first, even you know the old leather hats, when those things were introduced, some folks said, well, this will just mean that people will use their heads as weapons. And when face masks were introduced, people said, well, this just means that people will use the front of their heads as weapons. And so now they're finally trying to do something about it, and it's still people leaving with life-altering head injuries.
Well, yeah, Tony Dorsett, I think, is the latest to come out and say he's suffering from that. And, you know, when you think of a running back, you know he takes some hard hits, but you don't think of that guy like you do a lineman and the hits they take on every play, you know. And, you know, look at Muhammad Ali, greatest fighter in the world, and he can't talk now.
And didn't take that many blows to the head.
Nope. But the ones he did,
it doesn't take a bunch. And, you know, what we found out is that even though they're taking steps in college and professional football, I think statistically that the vast majority of really, really dangerous head injuries are happening in Pee Wee and Pop Warner and junior high and high school.
Well, yeah. Because I don't think it's as watched carefully, number one. And number two, you got a lot of kids who don't want to tell the coach that I'm hurt. You know, you get your bell rung and they evaluate you and you still can tell what day and time it is and everything. Sometimes that concussion isn't noticed right away, but also even if the player is feeling some effects, they don't want to come out of the game. So, you know, that's been a major source of the problem, and that's why the NFL has adopted some of the protocols they have to take it out of the player's hands of whether or not to come out of the game. And I'm sure they've done that on junior high and high school level now, but you've also got the extra thing of trying to teach players not to lead with their head or use their head. You know, it's all the way from Pee Wee up, you're almost having to reteach how to tackle.
And you have to remember that football itself, Kevin, was born inside the ranks of privilege. I just got a note from Jim pointing out something that I was about to mention myself, and that is football came very close to being outlawed outright in the Teddy Roosevelt administration, because the sons of the well-to-do at up east colleges where the sport was really taking hold were killing each other.
Yep.
I mean, they were not being carted off unconscious. They were being carted off the field dead.
Yep. Well, back then they were playing with no helmets. That didn't help a lot, you know. And they've made a lot of safety improvements, but still the concussion thing is the biggest. And the fear on any play, you could become disabled, you know. We've seen that all too often, too. And, of course, the NFL, it's been proven, has hid. They knew long ago that there was a problem with head injuries and didn't want to do anything about it. So, like you're saying, it goes back to money. And where the privilege years ago wanted to kill the game altogether, now the privilege are wanting to keep the game going because of that same thing, money. And so they're hiding injuries, or they were until they got caught at it. And they settled with that group of players to keep from that information from becoming public.
Right. The NFL is still an entirely disgusting corporate organization, and the fact, Kevin, that it operates as a 501c3 tax-exempt organization is absolutely sickening.
I couldn't believe that when I saw that. I did not know that until I saw that the other day. And how can that be? They make billions of dollars a year. How can they be a 501c3?
Well, but then again, it's like we talked about back when Cassie called. Not profit doesn't mean doesn't make profits.
Oh, no.
It's a different animal altogether. Kevin, it's been a great call. I'm going to try to get a couple more calls in. You have yourself a good evening.
Okay, you too, Bob.
All right, take care. Bye now. Our buddy Kevin calling from Colorado Springs. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Jeremy. What's happening?
Hey, I thought I'd tie the NFL and the head injuries and the military all together in one nice little story.
Okie doke.
I'm sure everyone remembers a gentleman named Pat Tillman.
Absolutely.
I believe I've called in and mentioned this before. I had a friend who was serving in the same province as he was in Afghanistan on the date he was killed. This same friend of mine has been in two tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan. I have never once thanked him for his service, except to shake his hand when he comes home and say, "Welcome home. I hope you're here for a while." And I think that's the greatest thing I could do for him. He enjoys that more than thank you for your service. He'd rather be home than in some dustbin around the world doing things which he's told to do. But anyway, back to Pat Tillman. We all know the story that he died courageously going up a hill in a friendly fire incident. My friend said that never happened. And I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "He rolled a Humvee into a ditch when he was horsing around."
Oh, jeez.
So they wanted to pump up his legend because he was an NFL star and people would know his name, so they said he was shot and killed. He got himself killed, unfortunately. It was an accident, messing around, but he truly rolled a Humvee in the ditch.
Wow. I mean,
that's been pumped. And even his mother pressed Congress in a couple of different places for a throw, just like Cindy Sheehan did. And to this day, they've never fully released it. At first, it was, hey, he got shot in the line of duty. He was shot charging a hill, trying to take a hill. Then it turned into friendly fire. They've never fully told the story because they want him as kind of a superhero, as something that people can look up to in the military.
God.
And that's not taking anything from the military.
And you know what? That becomes even more credible when you consider the bit of a shocking story that came out a few weeks ago with the folks saying that the story of that one Medal of Honor winner was just complete fabrication.
Right.
Never happened. But the government does this all the time. I'm trying to think of not Lindy England, not Abu Ghraib, the woman from Palestine, West Virginia.
Is the one that was taken, the first prisoner in the Iraq War?
Yeah, who valiantly fought until she had no more ammunition and blah, 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 only it turned out to be a line of complete and utter fabricated, meretricious garbage.
And then Iraqis actually saved her and didn't take her prisoner?
Yeah. Took her to the hospital, tried to save her life under impossible conditions.
Right. And then there's another famous in certain circles head injury story, and it comes from the WWE. Chris Benoit, a few years back, let's say 2005, murdered his whole family and then took his own life by hanging himself from a weight set. Now, they tried to brush that off as being a steroid rage, which to some extent maybe, but I think the true thing with head injuries, just like in the NFL, the front and shield head. In the 2005 era, they were still doing a lot of chair shots. And there's quite a few different stars when taken off the record. When they talk candidly about Chris Benoit, we'll mention that there's quite a few times when he's in the ring when he doesn't know who he was or where he was. He was basically performing muscle memory moves because he was so out of it from concussions from being hit with steel chairs.
Good God.
Since those times, they've greatly decreased the chair shot that people take and still tried to cage it as it was steroid rage, basically roid rage, and then it wasn't chair shots, even though they've taken away the chair shots and nothing like that has happened since then. But my true belief, it was more head injuries than anything.
Jeez. Oh, by the way, Jessica Lynch.
Yes, it's still in. That's her name, yeah. Yeah. I remember her story in 60 Minutes. Well, they were still somewhat credible. Not like lately. I also want to say that here's another piece of the puzzle of my life. In early let's say it was early, late, no, it was very early 2001. I had just come out of college. I wasn't very successful there, and I decided I was going to join the Navy. I went to the Navy. I was there for essentially 10 weeks. I washed out because I didn't have the mentality that you need to be in the Navy. Essentially, I wasn't good at taking orders and not questioning. I wasn't like that, but I just didn't. They could see I wasn't responding well to it. So basically, they took me aside and said, hey, this isn't cut out for everybody. No offense to you, but you'd be better off out of the military. Given the circumstances of what happened later that year, I'm glad that I never fully engaged in the military. I'm proud to have friends that have, but I'm glad I never went into, given what we've been into in the last 12 years.
No regrets.
No, it was an experience. I'll never forget when I broke off and went home. I walked through the streets of Chicago on a February morning with shorts and a t-shirt. That was an interesting experience when it's 14 below. But other than that, there's no regrets. It was a life experience. And it's funny, once they knew I was breaking off from the troops I was with, they treat you like a human again. They stop treating you like basically they do in base, where they beat you up and build you back up. And I explain it all, but in some ways I respect that they have their eyes out for that too, as guys that are training people, to look for people that may not fit that mold necessarily. And they didn't say it was they held nothing against me. They didn't say it was a bad thing. They just said mentally not everyone's cut out for this lifestyle, which I'm truly not. I don't really like orders bark at me very much for the most part.
Well, I guess everybody did you feel really compelled? I mean, to be there? I mean, or was it just...
I wasn't as driven as some people, I should say. I thought because it'd be a great way to see the world, maybe have some benefit, kind of a fun thing. And in the end, I think the reality that, see, what really happened was I got blood poisoning basically from the socks in the boots and wearing the socks all the time, went up into my leg. And I forget what it's called, but it's a specific kind of poisoning. I'm sure Jim's heard of it, or even Bill probably. But basically it runs up into your veins and it goes up to your legs like a spider web. Well, in the case of that, I also got severe hydration to the point where I had a headache and passed out throwing up on the toilet. I remember being brought down to the hospital on the base, which is Great Lakes. And when I got down there, they instantly gave me an IV. My headache went away. It was 100% dehydration. And they said, if you'd come tomorrow, you wouldn't have come. You'd been dead. So I was lucky in a lot of ways, and right after that's basically when I was detached and sent home. Granted, 9/11 happened 10 months later, so I got lucky, because in my case, probably it wouldn't have been so easy to let someone go after 9/11.
Oh, no. No, no. I was talking with Agnes the other day and reminding her of back at the height of the second Bush War, that standards were lowered so far into the toilet in the Army that we were accepting known rapists into the ranks.
I'm surprised. Don't you remember the story about Palin's son going, and she was bragging all about during the campaign? Hey, my son signed up for the whatever branch of the military it was, and it turned out he didn't sign up. He was given an ultimatum.
Yeah.
Go work, go in the military, or do time in jail.
Exactly. Exactly. Hey, Jeremy, got to roll.
Yep.
You have yourself a good evening. Thank you for sharing that.
You too. No problem.
Bye now. Jeremy calling from Vermont. And is this another person or not? Hey, welcome to the program.
Person.
Cool.
Bob, I just want to recognize your father, your own decision concerning patriotism, Jim and Kevin. Jim's situation and your own are actually, to me, as a Midwest Yankee, slightly to more, way more profound than my own. Jim's situation where the doctors helped him growing up, and for Jim and for yourself not to serve and for Jim to serve were both really acts of bravery and courage, reaching beyond the ethnic struggles that the country had. And I would just guess Jim's doctor, as he was treated for probably concerns with his lungs, may have been a Southern white male who was educated through wars, from possibly World War One, or probably World War One, guessing Jim's age. But the point is, and I'm not belittling or the point is, it's all economically connected, and people, any case, it was a poor person that got, that had the intelligence to get educated, to help people that had the intelligence to get educated. But it ultimately, and I'm not making a comment personally to anybody, it's always for the furtherment of profitability at the sake of people's love for each other and natural desires to support each other. And for people to reach above that is actually a higher degree of love or patriotism to me, to not just automatically deny defending yourself, but to question. And as a Marine, we're taught, I just watched a Democracy on Free Speech TV today. Bob, I know you got a couple seconds left. They had the lead up to the Iraq War, and U.S. Marine General Peter Pace, working with Rumsfeld, they actually couldn't even get it down straight on what the policy was for soldiers witnessing abuse, even though the Americans were...
Well, they couldn't get anything straight, Mark. They couldn't even get their own lives straight. I mean,
right.
Weapons of mass destruction, yellow cake, mushroom cloud, evil dictator who kills his own people.
Freedom and democracy.
Freedom and democracy. Oh, I forgot. Freedom and democracy.
And to even understand your own son, you know, Ulysses S. Grant's father wanted the boy to go to West Point and knew a congressman in Ohio. Grant, if listening to the country's leading expert on Ulysses S. Grant, is an SIU professor. So the Grant's quote, as he steps on the barge to float east to West Point, was, "I hope this barge sinks." So, you know, question is all I'm saying. Question the reality and question. It's not the love for each other and love for family or respecting our fathers, but your decision. Many, and I'll hang up at this, many World War II veterans didn't want their sons to serve in Vietnam, and I would see that not dissimilar to your own. My father also wanted me, Jim, Bob, to go to the Naval Academy, possibly. I maybe could have handled part of it, but maybe not the other part of it. You could have handled probably all of it, maybe the physical part. I could have handled the physical and then all the men, some of them.
Oh, I would have washed out on the math. There's no doubt I would have washed on the math.
I think you would have stumped me in math, but the point is, the land grants and the GI Bill, the land grants that were given to states, north and south, to educate people that work for a living, and also the GI Bill, who had helped and who it did not.
Well, I turned out to be a land grant kid, but I got to get out of here, Mark. I really do.
As a grunt, I respect your education. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good evening. And thanks everybody for joining in this evening. Thanks for getting us all the way to we're just $25 short of finishing the evening's fundraising. Thank you very much for all of that. And time to get out of here, because Rick Smith is next. A very peaceful, introspective remainder of the day to you all. See you tomorrow.